Deriving Doctrine, Part 3. The 18th talk in a series on Foundations of Knowing the Truth was presented by David Crabtree on May 19, 1992, at McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2014. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side. The following recording was made in a classroom setting, and some of the students' questions were inaudible. It is hoped that Dr. Crabtree's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
I guess just out of a force of habit or tradition or something, I'll go through, briefly describe the approach that I have come to believe is true as to how we are supposed to move from an interpretation of the Bible to acting on that information. And you could probably draw this for me by now, but I conceive it as a three-step process, the first of which is to gather information, and when we're trying to, the next step is to interpret that information, and the third step is to build a model of God's worldview. That's the goal of this part of the process, is to reconstruct in our own minds a model of how God looks at the world. And I have used the term a theology for this model. But you have to understand that by using this word theology, I'm expanding it beyond all known definitions. Because typically theology is a study, very technically, theology is the study of God. Theos is God. Logos is the logic of it. Reasoning about God. So theology, very narrowly speaking, is the study of God. But we typically use theology to talk about spiritual things, the study of spiritual things, or the description of spiritual things. Well, I'm expanding it even further to be all of God's worldview. So that if that's not helpful, don't use that word, but if I use it this way, that's what I'm doing. Now, the information that we gather, on which all of this model is built, comes from two sources primarily. One is the Bible, and the other is our experience of reality. They are different kinds of information, but they are both authored by God, and therefore they ought to be consistent. They ought to go together. Where they don't go together, we've made a mistake somewhere. There's something we're misunderstanding. Either we've misunderstood the Bible, or we've misunderstood experience, or we've misunderstood both. Okay, once we have built, from this information, we have built a model of God's worldview, then we can look at any situation in our lives through God's eyes, to the extent that that's complete and correct. We can look at that through God's eyes, and therefore determine what God would have us do. Now, last week, we talked about buying and selling. Generally speaking, it is difficult to carry over conversations, but are there remaining questions from last week's discussion that you've been thinking about and we could pick up with? So you're working for yourself, mm-hmm. and you're setting prices for things that you are producing. Now, there are built-in, obviously, there are built-in limits on this. If you charge 50 cents an hour, you probably won't do it very long. If you charge $500 an hour, likewise, you probably won't do it very long. That there are built-in parameters on this. To what extent, then, would you say you have an option? So we're talking about, you're saying, if I market in one place, I'm only going to get $5 an hour. But I know that there's another place where I can take those same things and sell them at a price that comes out to about $8 an hour. And presumably there's someplace else where I could go and I could make $15 an hour. You'd like to know where that is, right? And why would you, and what principle then would you rely upon? Intended to be a quiz.
That's good.
But ultimately, if we're going to, if that thinking is right, there must be a principle up here. Now, it may be difficult to articulate, but there must be a principle that's coming into play that distinguishes the item which is a necessity from an item which is a luxury. Do you see what I'm saying? Presumably such a thing exists. It may be difficult to articulate, but presumably it exists. So the do unto others, why would that be different? Why would there be a difference there between a necessity and a luxury?
I think in the retail realm, one of the principles, God can't be on this, but it seems like supply and demand is a principle that's real functional in retail. Mm-hmm. And I don't see these being a real moral issue. If one neighborhood would yield you $5 an hour and another neighborhood would yield you $15 an hour, there would be a price you'd have to pay personally on all different levels, but that would be your choice just as the people that would be buying it. Mm-hmm. So there's freedom and choice in the retail exchange. If you were selling bandages or medicine or milk, that somehow a little bit more social conscience would come into it. But okay. This.
I remember taking economics in college and I loved those supply and demand curves. Let's see, how does this work? The supply and demand across a certain place, and so there's your, I don't remember how it worked. But anyway, the problem, there are some commodities where the supply and demand curve does work. But I think as Annette has indicated, there are a lot where that's kind of a fiction, that you can't plot that. We have a little business where we sell some gift food products. And how do you compare we have a chocolate truffle, for instance. How do you compare our chocolate truffle to all the other chocolate truffles? Well, ours is different. Whether it's better or whether it's worse, it's different. And so how do you compare it? How do you establish a price on it? How do you come up with your supply-demand curve? How you market it, how you present it, how you conceive of it, all ends up influencing what price. But it is establishing that supply and demand curve for a lot of commodities is a lot more arbitrary than economics would have us believe. But let's say it is a commodity where supply and demand is well established. Let's say it's wheat, where it's wheat of the same kind, same quality, and therefore the price is well established. Does that then mean that we should sell it for that price? Let me give you an example. And this is one of the factors that led to the French Revolution. There were farmers, there were landowners who were shipping barge loads of wheat through the canals of Paris to export it to England. And yet there wasn't enough grain for the people in France to eat. There were people starving, watching the grain go by on the canal. And I think that's what you were getting at, the principle of that there are some things that are necessities and there are other things that are luxuries, and maybe they ought to be handled differently.
Well, I think, and this is out of context, but I think of the story about the farmer, the story in the Bible about the farmer who holds a silo of wheat until the price goes up. And I don't really know where it's at, but they say don't do that. Wait, sell it when you have it, instead of holding on to it or hoarding it until the price goes up.
I don't remember. I can't think of the story.
I'll find it.
But it'll be interesting to see what the context is and what point is being made there.
Yeah, isn't that the one about him saying that you don't want to lay it up in your barn and
right.
save it and save it because your soul might be required that night?
Right.
He tells that,
right.
Jesus.
That isn't a lesson in economics.
No, it probably isn't a lesson in economics, exactly.
Well, it is related. It is related in a sense.
Because he's holding it.
If the question is what... But thinking of that, the situation in France where barge loads of grain were being shipped by their neighbors so that they could sell it overseas. There's something perverse about that, in that compassion ought to lead them to somehow make that available to their starving neighbors. Okay, if it is true that you have the kind of commodity where you can kind of name your price, depending on who you market it to, now what else do we use to decide? Is there something that, a principle that is operative here that we need to think about? Why are you making them? Whatever you're making, widgets. Let's say you're making widgets. Why are you making widgets? These are creative widgets. Okay. What if you could sell them at a price that got you $300 an hour? There's something inadequate, there's something deficient about the service being offered if the price is too low.
Well, that's that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, marketing, a lot of marketing is designed to appeal to perverse desires that are in us and create a sense of need where there really isn't need. And it's just, that is part of the society that we live in. It's inescapable. That is a fact. And how to live, and that's the question that we keep running into, is how do we live on values which are genuinely biblical in a world that doesn't share those values, that has completely different values? And part of the problem is a problem of communication, a problem of how do I represent myself accurately in a culture that doesn't understand me at all? I think...
May I answer?
Sure.
Very poorly.
Really true.
I was just thinking of what you said, taking everybody in this room, and how do we market what we think are biblical principles in a world that doesn't value those principles? Very frequently we don't.
Yeah.
And it's very common, it's very the nature of me to participate in that world the way others do.
Mm-hmm.
And only at times do I fall into a different perspective that's sometimes very, very wonderful and very, very tasteful and very, very enjoyable. And it's other times I think we're struggling with how we present ourselves in the world.
And putting ourselves in that position can put us at risk in this world.
Yes.
On the greater.
You mean living by biblical principles as best we understand it. There's no question about it.
And putting ourselves in the world can put us at other great risks.
Yeah.
and we're struggling with that.
That's
exactly right. And that's good. I think we should be struggling. Because that's growth.
That's one of the things that most struck me when I was thinking through this process, is that it is frustrating initially, I suppose even later, but it's frustrating that God didn't make things clearer. He could have provided for us to know in every situation what we ought to do, but he has chosen not to do that. Instead, he leaves us in this kind of fog where we struggle with figuring out what he would have us do. And I'm convinced that the reason is because there is great benefit that comes from that, from struggling with it. We learn about ourselves, we learn about God in a way that we wouldn't otherwise. And part of what we're doing is, and this I think is a partial answer to your question of what price to charge, I think ultimately it's arbitrary. There's probably a range within which one could choose, and you might as well throw a dart. There are extremes at which it would be, there's something wrong with it. But within a range, it's relatively arbitrary. But as we're sorting that out, the question we have to continually ask ourselves is, why would I be attaching this value to my work as opposed to this other value to my work? Is it like some of the things that were suggested, that I want to see my work as more valuable? And then the question is, should I be doing that? Is that a good thing or is that a bad thing? Is it so I can sell more so I'll feel better about it, so a lower price? Is that good or is that bad? And it's sorting through those questions and what's going on within us that I think is really valuable in the process.
Can I throw out another question?
Sure.
I've often wondered if I, as an attorney, could assume in calculating my fees that my time is worth $25 an hour when my client who's working in the woods is earning $10 an hour. Why am I in any position to assume that I can, I'm worth $25 an hour and he's only worth $10 an hour? If I'm trading his hours for my hours, in a sense, Mom, in essence, that's what I'm doing.
Mom's glad you're retired.
Well,
I'm thinking about this.
Consider all you spent on school.
I was thinking about that when I was riding my bike to classes today. It is bizarre the way our society has evolved and therefore the manner in which it assigns value to different people's activities. And I would say that ultimately that too is rather arbitrary. You take something like Clyde Drexler, who's playing basketball right now presumably and hopefully well, but he is making a fortune because he has a certain set of skills that at this time and in this culture are very valued. What if he was living in Russia right now? He wouldn't be getting much of anything. What if he lived at another time when basketball was not a valued activity? So it's just that he came along with the right set of skills at the right set of at the right time in the right place to be paid a lot of money for that. And I think we need to keep that in perspective, that values are ultimately quite arbitrary. And we shouldn't confuse, as the world does. The world says the dollar amount that's attached to something is what it's worth. The world has a difficult time figuring out another way to assign value. But we need to make sure that, keep it separate, that is not its real value. That is an arbitrary figure that's kind of, through different historical forces, has come to be assigned to that activity.
Drexler's request for so much money, as it is when you're dealing with a client or a customer, person to person, yeah. He doesn't have to deal with people at the gate and say, yeah. If you want to come in and see me, you got to pay so much money. He doesn't have to do that.
Yeah.
Yes, but they both require social derivation. They're both derived from the interaction of society. Society over time placed a value on college and legal education and prominence in society and position and assigned a relative, not $25, but a relative dollar value to the legal profession and kept the hunters and gatherers at a little bit different level of accomplishment. And if everyone in this state decided not to go to the basketball game tonight, Clyde Drexler's talents wouldn't be very, very valuable.
Right.
We have always, since the Romans, the gladiators and the Romans, I mean, the Romans go to the Colosseum to watch the gladiators. Mm-hmm. They've been doing that for forever and ever, and it seems to be one of our mm-hmm. our natures, the vicarious enjoyment of athleticism. Mm-hmm. And society has determined that. It's kind of, the prices keep going up and up and up. It's phenomenal to me. And I see yours and my professions as having been placed in a level of respect and position that I didn't have anything to do with. It came before me and before you. As a matter of fact, I, in medicine, am going through an experience where doctors being knocked off the pedestal, so to speak. The national impact of the expense of medicine is so phenomenal that other controls have had to have been added, and they're happening at a time that seems to make it tumultuous, and physicians react and say, I'm being gypped, I'm being knocked down unfairly, but they become mm-hmm. used to a social position, and now society says, hey, that's not so good because we're running out of cash. And so Medicare and Medicaid and insurance carriers and everybody else is knocking it down, putting it in perspective. That's society acting, and it's kind of a trial and error exposure. And I think that within those realms of the worldly position, then I think it is yours and my responsibility to be moral and ethical about the somewhat of a modification. You see the hunter and gatherer come in and you give him a discount because, boy, you've got some compassion in your heart for him. And someone who wouldn't instill that kind of feeling to you might pay the regular fee. I think we have the option to act that way. We can write off a debt when it's appropriate. We can say it's not necessary to pay. Those are things that we continue to experience, and we're confounded by them, and that's why we're asking these questions. And I feel very much better for just having heard your responses and had a chance to comment myself, because I know you struggle just like I struggle. And we're going to do it with, I think, a little bit more in-depth concern in the future. Nothing about finances. But your presentation is very good and very appropriate. I would want to say no. I would share with you the fact that the Hippocratic Oath isn't professed anymore. Mm-hmm. It's been changed about 3 or 4 times from its inception. But still, the serving profession, I think, have a moral and altruistic component, which is unwritten. Mm-hmm. And I think that in many cases, it's practiced in a profession of medicine very well and very high and very openly. Thousands of dollars are written off yearly by each physician in caring for the people without money. Mm-hmm. And that's, I still think the answer is personal struggle. I don't think there's an answer to your question. I think my comments about the fact that society placed the medical profession somewhat higher than the pastoral profession is a function of society and a function of what society saw as relative values. Isn't that sad, you know? But that's the way the world saw it. And I have an opportunity to pay that back. And it depends upon the gathering and the interpretation of that information and how I react as to whether or not I cancel someone's bill, work on a lot of welfare patients. And I think you'll find in this community, especially at Sacred Heart Hospital, that no one is ever. And that's really special to me at that particular hospital. But I know it exists. And I know that in the city of Chicago and Los Angeles that there are physicians who have abused the Medicare rules and regulations and have stolen thousands of dollars. And that saddens me. But it's so much personal interpretation of my value and my worth. And rather than the dollar and cents, I struggle more with the aggrandizement of the position. I struggle more with self-worth in reference to the appearance, although the dollar sign hurts because I have to raise kids and pay college fees and pay for weddings and send kids further on to school as well. Though the dollar sign is appropriate, I have to earn a living. More important and more difficult for, I think, many people in the medical profession is struggling over their peer relationship, their apparent worth and quality, their performance, whether it be 50 patients a day or 3 patients a day, done slowly and carefully and wisely, and the decisions about making those kinds of decisions about care and time and attention. But yet I would still conclude and feel no difficulty or no personal embarrassment that within the realm of the social position that I think society has put physicians in and pastors in, there lies enough room for each to act and react appropriately with his or her time, either in giving time or canceling a debt. There's nothing more thrilling to me than to know someone in need and have the opportunity to cancel a debt. That's been a special pleasure at times. And at other times, I know that I made the decision, you know, to cancel part of it, or they should pay some, or those kind of things are moral decisions. And in the past, I bet you I've probably handled them more because of social upbringing than any inborn error. I think David's comment is terrific. God didn't make it that clear to us. I was just thinking about that the other day. Now, how come you didn't do it more clear, God? It would have made it a lot easier. But that was very precious the way you said that. That's really very true. I've said enough.
I think it's important for us to recognize that fairness with respect to our position in life, the amount of money we have and the kind of family we're in and that sort of thing, that too is not something that God values. We are in very different economic situations, different family situations, different societal situations, and that's all part of God's working. I think we need to see money as just another resource that God has given us, besides skills, opportunities, those kinds of things as well. And so if someone is an attorney, for instance, that is, God has brought that about. That is a privilege that has been given to that person, and a resource that has been given to that person to then use for God's purposes as wisely as they can. Same thing with money. Money's the same thing. So I think the important thing is to see those things as something that God has granted me for me to use wisely with His interests in mind. I think that this comes back to what I was saying to Annette, that part of this process forces out some of those issues. Why am I doing what I'm doing? And that's an excellent opportunity for us to look at it squarely and say, now how does this line up with biblical principles? And dealt with enough ethical issues seriously, what you'll find is you have natural tendencies to drift in one direction or another. For instance, when I'm deciding what my time is worth, I tend to be on the upside. And when I'm deciding what I should pay someone else, it's on the downside. But you become aware of some of the things that are pulling on you inside. And I think one of the crucial things here is to be absolutely honest with ourselves, and it's very difficult. But we need to be, like you're saying, we need to be absolutely honest with ourselves. Why am I doing what I'm doing? And in my experience, when it's a very tough ethical issue, at the time, I usually lie to myself. It's only in retrospect that it's clear that I lied to myself. and I think in the life of Abraham, I think we see some of that. It's really striking to me. And that's true in my experience. It's very difficult to be honest with ourselves when there's something at stake. I think there are a number of times with Sarah, when he says that she is his sister, mm-hmm. twice. And the other time, having a child through Hagar. Mm-hmm.
This might be kind of, well, I don't know, I guess it comes in, but I had a struggle of, I decided I was going to be, really seek to be righteous. And so right away, when I went to a store, she made a mistake and gave me $3 too much. And I didn't notice it right away. When I went out, I noticed it. I went back and I gave her the $3, which she said, oh, I hope I don't get in trouble. And then I thought, well now, God, what am I supposed to do? I don't want to get the girl in trouble, but I wanted to give back the money. Mm-hmm. What do you do? Mm-hmm. And that happened two more times after that. And I thought, God, what are you trying to show me? What is the answer? Do you want to get a girl in trouble? Yeah. Another time then, she was glad. Mm-hmm. But twice they said, ooh, I hope I don't get in trouble. What do you do? Do you be honest and give them back the money and get the girl in trouble? Or
I haven't got the answer yet.
Well, I don't know why that hit me three times, you know, just after I was trying so hard. Anyway. But there are things like that that come up that are really problems.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah.
Let me give you just a few comments as a summary of this process that we've talked about. The first is, I hope that you appreciate how difficult it is to sort some of these things out. They are not cut and dried. It takes a lot of soul searching, I think, to a large extent of soul searching, to figure out what we ought to do in any given situation. And I'm convinced God has done that for a reason. And there's no way around it. But there are a few implications from that. One is, doing the right thing is not what is foremost in God's agenda. That is not his major concern, that we do the right thing at every turn in the road. If that was his concern, he would have made it clearer. There's something else that he has in mind, the process. But there is something gained by us going through the process, struggling with it, and even making mistakes. The other thing is, when you realize the complexity of some of these things, it becomes very difficult to stand judge over other people's decisions with respect to ethical issues. Now, there are some times when it's clear what they have done is wrong. I think that's true, and we can call people on it. But I think that, at least in the past, my tendency has been to think that these kinds of issues are, for the most part, cut and dry, and that it's easy to evaluate whether someone has acted wrongly. But the more I realize the complexity of these issues and how many factors come into play, it's more difficult to make that kind of judgment. I can watch people, and I can make assessments that I think are right, but I need to kind of suspend that unless things are really clear. And the other thing is, we are really at the mercy of God in this whole process, and we have to bring to it a great deal of humility. We have to come with the attitude, God, teach me, and be willing to sit at his feet and learn through a situation, through our struggling with an ethical issue. And we make our best guess, we act on it, and then we say, God, have mercy on me. I don't know if I've done the right thing or not. God, have mercy on me.
Do you think that piece of advice applies to moral issues only, or physical issues as well? The accomplishment of a task might be another opportunity to learn and grow. But do we look only to the moral issues, or do the worldly business and physical decisions, is that within God's process also?
Well, I think ultimately that is involved in what God is doing with us. But he puts a higher value on issues of righteousness. Mm-hmm. And therefore, that's where he's primarily involved. I mean, that's where he puts his emphasis in our lives and in our experience.
Although it might be a money or a business decision, the mechanism of coming to that conclusion, the righteousness of a biblical perspective, is more the point than the solution of the issue or the problem.
In any decision, ultimately there are ethical issues somewhere. There are values that are coming to bear. The goal is to do the right thing. There's no question about that. But what I'm arguing is that God has so constructed things that the process of trying to figure out what the right thing to do, that process itself is of greater value than getting the right answer at any given point in time. Well, I think...
You were saying...
Right. I think that there are decisions that we make where there is no right nor wrong answer. For instance, I'm looking at coats. Should I buy a blue one or a green one? Ultimately, there is no right or wrong answer there. But that has to be determined. That's all part of the process, in a sense. As we look at it through God's eyes and we say, there is no value, divinely determined value here that is coming to bear on this.
Well, there's with the mercy of God.
We are clearly torn.
I wasn't trying to take off or be facetious. We're not righteous.
No
man is righteous, not even one. And there's where the struggle is.
Right. That's right.
But then her comment was a confusion for me. If we want to be righteous, I'm not sure about the active role I play in that. And I don't know how much.
Well, we're struggling right now to understand what would be the right thing to do. The struggle's within us. It isn't for some. Some people don't want to know. Don't care. I mean, the world's perception of it would make me look the fool for agonizing as I do over certain things.
God could have done things differently. God could have zapped us with righteousness such that there would be no struggle. He could have done that. But he didn't. There's something to be gained by that agony, that struggle that we go through. And I keep thinking back to, why did Adam and Eve eat of the fruit in the first place? God could have accomplished what he wanted to accomplish in a very different way, in a sense. I mean, he could have made us righteous. Well, that's ultimately his purpose includes us going through sinfulness, being sinners, and going through the process of being redeemed. And I think the same thing is true of that struggle within us to do what is right, but that too is part of the process, ultimately, apparently, inescapable in order to get us where he wants us to go. Thank you.